Welcome, everybody, to what I believe will be the last installment of our long-running hit game show, What is Janet Yellen Thinking Now? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is a Friday. This one's the 6th day of November. Great, as always, to have you along, gang. We're going to get to today's installment of WIJYTN in just a minute. Think about it. WIJYTN. There you go. First, though, from the Marketplace desk of We All Knew This One Was Coming, the White House said today it is going to reject the Keystone XL pipeline, the one that would bring crude oil from the Canadian tar sands down through the lower 48. The review of the project proposed by TransCanada, you remember, had until this morning been going on for 7 years. Now, before you get lost in all the polemics that have and will surround this thing, remember this, it was always more of a political issue, this pipeline, than an economic one. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Environmentalists said the Keystone Pipeline would be a climate disaster. Pipeline supporters said it would create tens of thousands of jobs. But actually, both sides exaggerated. Take the job argument. Tens of thousands of workers might have been needed to build the pipeline, but once it was finished, you wouldn't need nearly that many people to run it.
I suspect it's less than 100.
That's Michael Levy, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Levy says environmentalist claims were also exaggerated. Levy says they used the pipeline as an easy-to-understand symbol.
It was concrete. It was easy to talk about. It wasn't something confusing like Section 111D regulations under the EPA's authority.
Even President Obama complained today about how political the pipeline had gotten.
It became a symbol too often used as a campaign cudgel by both parties rather than a serious policy matter.
The president's critics shot back that he'd done much of the politicizing. And I know this is shocking, but the politics won't go away. Sarah Ladislaw is the energy program director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She wonders if this same thing will happen to other big projects.
Because it's probably, going to live on as this litmus test or this political football.
And Ladislaw says the Keystone Pipeline decision will become a big part of the 2016 presidential campaign. We have so much to look forward to. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, so this is a true story. A couple of weeks ago, I emailed a guy I know at the Federal Reserve, and I asked him if Janet Yellen would like to play along in a round of What is Janet Yellen Thinking Now? He wrote back and he said, thanks for thinking of us, but no thanks. So, hey, I gave it a shot. But here on Jobs Day to play the game live on the radio are John Carney from the Wall Street Journal. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Lynette, so here we go. 271,000 new jobs. The rate falls to 5.0%. First of all, what is Janet Yellen thinking now? Remember the rules, 5 words or less. Wow.
Well,
really?
maybe I just hike.
Well, maybe I just hike. Okay, that was pretty good. The dead air kind of got me going, but that's neither here nor there.
I gotta think about it.
John, what do you got?
Here we go.
It's only three, dude. All right. Well, I guess I never say anything about a minimum requirement. So, both of you agree it's coming in December, the rate hike.
I think she's thinking about it coming in December.
No, come on, seriously, just thinking.
I mean, she said that she wanted to do it before the end of the year, but she's very data dependent.
Yep.
Who knows what's going to happen? And they took the language out of the last memo that said, we are concerned about what's going on overseas. But who knows? Something crazy could happen somewhere else in the world.
Remember how close we came last time? We got all the way up to mid-August, and everybody said, it's going to come in September. Yep. Here it comes. And then just about a month before, we had China, the world started to look problematic, and suddenly no more hikes. So,
exactly.
That's why you play the game. All right,
absolutely.
Fair enough. So let's get into the jobs report for real. Lynette, I want to talk to you about wages, right? Every time we've had you on Jobs Day. I know. That's what I said at the meeting this morning. I said, we can't do any spots on wages because Lynette's on the wrap. So here's what I want to know. Wages up 2.5% year on year. That's not enough.
I mean, we still need to see some more slack in the labor market. There's too much slack, rather.
Too much slack.
I think wages still need to go up. I think people still need to work more hours per week. I think our hourly hours worked per week is still, 34 per person? We could do better.
All right.
I'm not... you know, we're looking for an economy that's strong enough to support 0.25% hike in rates, not like,
right.
you know, escape velocity, which is what we used to talk about all the time when the crisis happened, which was almost like a rocket going off and we were right. suddenly back in 1995. Yeah.
Well, so John, let me ask you this, though, right? So wages up 2.5% year on year. There is fundamentally no inflation in this economy. Whatever happened to the whole inflation discussion? Because now that everybody's thinking she's going to raise in December, where are we with inflation? There's no inflation in this economy.
Right. Well, one thing I would say is the Fed, this reveals what the Fed's bias really is here. It wants to raise rates. It's not being forced to raise rates. There's no danger of inflation at all right now in the economy. Even this wage hike, as there's still enough slack, despite the low unemployment in the labor market, that we're not seeing any inflationary pressures. And so the Fed is, what's really happening is the Fed is probably at the place where it feels comfortable hiking, but there's nothing forcing its hand. If it didn't want to hike, it would not have to.
Lynette, let me ask you, and this is kind of an anecdotal question, right? But we've been doing a lot of coverage this week, and we're going to be doing it for the rest of the year through Election Day on what people are actually feeling out there, away from the headline numbers. And what we're feeling is that people are still a little utsy. They're a little anxious. They're not feeling the 5% unemployment rate. They're not feeling the 271,000 new jobs. Why do you suppose that is?
I think, for one thing, we have a lot of politicians in an election cycle who are making things sound really, really terrifying. Yeah. I don't want to name any names, but Make America Great Again, when America is doing pretty well in terms of how the global economy is doing, is not necessarily the most accurate message to send out to the American people. Yeah. And are they feeling it in their wallets? Yeah, I think, again, wages could be higher. It helps that oil prices are lower. And we saw consumer credit explode this month or just today. Yeah. So I don't know. It's very confusing.
I think part of what's happening here is that people are way behind where they would have expected to be.
Yeah.
So even though we're seeing some wage pressure now, we haven't seen that for so long that on a normalized basis, people would have been expected to have better jobs. People would have been expected to be earning more. So if you ask somebody 2 years ago, where do you think your income and your bank account will be a couple of years from now? They would have thought higher than it is now. So even if things are starting to look better now,
we're
way behind where we should be.
John Carney from The Wall Street Journal, Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Thanks, you guys.
Have a great weekend.
All right,
you too. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye. On Wall Street today, traders kind of took their time figuring out that jobs report and in the end, basically shrugged it off. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Amazing as it sounds, given where the jobless rate was not all that long ago, there is a question that does kind of need to start being discussed. How much lower do you suppose the unemployment rate can go anyway, and what's it going to look like when it gets there? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman with that.
Historically, unemployment's been well below 5%, 3.5% in the summer of 68, under 4% at the end of the 90s boom. Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute recalls those good times.
We saw substantial wage growth across the wage distribution, a full employment economy, a tighter economy.
The reason? Something economists call the Phillips curve. Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics explains.
As the unemployment rate goes down, as there are fewer people out of work and more people already in work, employers find it harder to get hold of new workers, and therefore they have to pay higher wages.
And that's what Amy Glazer at national staffing firm Adecco says she's seeing now.
You know, we're definitely seeing the tables turn from an employer's market to a job seeker's market.
Her clients are trying to hire clerical and medical workers, temps for the holiday shopping rush.
We're seeing clients increase pay rates from $1 to $3 and $4 an hour. We're seeing sign-on bonuses, retention bonuses.
Now, the theory also says if wages go up, employers will pass that increased cost on to consumers, says Mike Bale at U.S. Bank.
We would start to see price inflation show up in a lot of areas, and that's something that the market and investors are not prepared for.
It's also possible that today's report of stronger wage gains in October is just a one-month blip, and that anemic wage growth will stick around for a while longer. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Also soon to be at full employment, the general counsel's office at ExxonMobil, the world's biggest publicly traded oil company, is being investigated by the New York State Attorney General, subpoena in hand, looking for reams of documents related to climate change, specifically what Exxon knew about global warming versus what it said. Did it mislead the public? And also, did it mislead its investors? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
If you are a public company, there are some things you have to tell investors about under securities laws, like risks.
It's very typical for any large company to disclose a whole laundry list of risks.
Lynn Stout is professor of corporate and business law at Cornell.
From the potential failure of products being developed to issues like this, the impact of climate change and possible regulatory responses.
Since 2010, climate change has been understood as something corporations have to talk about if it could affect them. Donna Dabney directs the Governance Center at the Conference Board.
The issue with climate change is that companies tend to have trouble with the probability part.
How much will the sea rise? When will it rise? Will it flood my plants? ExxonMobil, of course, is an oil and gas company for which the impact of climate change is patently significant.
ExxonMobil has consistently, in public, communicated a message of doubt and uncertainty about climate science. But what the recent revelations show is that in private they were having a very, very different conversation.
That's the view of Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science at Harvard. Exxon didn't respond to a request for comment. It's also what the New York Attorney General is investigating under a state law related to securities fraud called the Martin Act. J.W. Verrett teaches at George Mason Law School.
The phrases in the Martin Act are very, very broad, and an attorney general can use that and the incredible penalties associated with it to leverage settlement very quickly, and they have.
This is the same law that led to a settlement with Bank of America after the financial crisis of almost $17 billion. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
A correction now before we go on. In a story earlier this week about the drug Vivitrol, which is used to treat drug addiction, we incorrectly described what the National Association of Drug Court Professionals does. It trains drug court professionals. We also mischaracterized what the group's chief operating officer said about the company that makes Vivitrol. He did not say that it's donating the drug to public agencies to get them to pay for it later. Coming up.
It's certainly French for you're going to get canceled soon.
Wait, it is? The new fall TV season straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 46 points today, 0.25%, closed at 17,910. The NASDAQ up 19 points, more than 0.3%, finished at 5147. The S&P 500 off just a hair, flat at 2099. For the week, the Dow up 1.4%, the NASDAQ up 1.8%, the S&P up 1% on the nose. So pick it up with jobs numbers. If you believe that they make an interest rate hike more likely, which I do, then you'll also believe it's a good time to snap up bank stocks, since those higher rates would mean more income for banks from their lending. Shares in Bank of America, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and JPMorgan Chase all up at least 3% today. And oh yeah, bond prices, they fell as the yield on the 10-year Tino, get a load of this, rose to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This morning, Russia suspended all passenger flights to Egypt following British intelligence claims that last week's plane crash near the resort of Sharm el-Sheikh may have been caused by a bomb. The disaster came as the British government's plan to strengthen its intelligence gathering system moves forward. A draft bill unveiled this week aims to tighten up surveillance of the internet. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The Home Secretary, Theresa May, launched her bill in Parliament this week. She said the new law would drag British surveillance into the 21st century.
It will give the men and women of our security and intelligence agencies and our law enforcement agencies the powers they need to protect our country.
And the most controversial of the new powers, phone and internet companies would be forced to keep for a year a record of whom their customers have called and what websites they visited. Security services could then access that data with a judge's approval. We need this, says Police Chief Sarah Thornton.
If we don't modernise, we're falling behind with technology and we just have more dark areas where we don't know what's happening.
But the plan has provoked a hail of criticism. Here's what Glenn Greenwald, the journalist who broke the story about CIA man Edward Snowden, told the BBC.
It is radical to say that every single person's browsing history must be kept and stored and made available to the government if the government wants it.
And from his exile in Moscow, Snowden himself tweeted,
Britain would have one of the most intrusive and least accountable surveillance systems in the West.
Others argue that this bulk surveillance would create huge stockpiles of personal data that would become a paradise for hackers. And Danvers Balio of the digital security firm Privac says the measure will hardly bother the terrorists and the crooks.
You can use all sorts of different technologies that are out there to circumvent it. We all know that criminals don't use their home phone number to plot their evil schemes. They use burner phones and that kind of thing to get around this.
The government says this measure is what the intelligence agencies are calling for, and the British public seems relatively relaxed about this level of surveillance. 53% in a recent poll said they were okay with it. Parliament votes on the bill next year. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There's something quite remarkable happening in television in this new fall season. Usually by this point in the rollout of new shows, at least one of them has been canceled. And to be honest, there are some contenders to be the first one down. Minority Report, Blood and Oil, The Player. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has this look at why some struggling shows are still on the air.
Manhattan Love Story was the first cancellation of last year's fall season.
Hello, sexy. I don't believe we've met.
ABC dumped it four episodes in. Back in 2013, Lucky 7 was yanked after just two episodes. And in 2012...
You are a fancy lady lawyer.
Who was fired when CBS dumped Made in Jersey after only two airings. So history tells us we should have a cancellation by now. So do critics who've written some joyfully scathing reviews of the season's new shows. But networks, they're showing a little patience.
I think the metric has changed.
Warren Littlefield is the executive producer of Fargo on FX and former president of NBC Entertainment. He says a show used to live or die on the ratings that came out the day after it aired. But now studio executives and advertisers look at the numbers over a few days or even a week. They pay attention to how a show does online and what kind of buzz it's getting.
For me, it's a sea change of trying to pound that into my brain and go, oh, because I spent 20 years at NBC waking up with overnights and waiting for nationals.
It's not just ratings and the way we watch that are changing the cancellation calendar. In a counterintuitive twist, the intense competition for our attention has meant even weak shows are given a little longer to catch on. Then there's the competition for talent and ideas for this season and next. Littlefield says being quick to dump a show is no way for a network to endear itself to a future Shonda Rhimes.
The notion that you've spent a year on something and it's on in 1 week and then canceled and gone the next is no way to bring the creative community to your doorstep.
It's also no way to make the studio bean counters happy. Tom Noonan is a lecturer at UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television.
It's much, much more expensive to market a show and break through the noise than it has been in the past.
He says networks spend as much as $20 million to advertise a new show. And most of that money, it's already out the door.
As far as the fall campaign goes, yes. Over 75% of the marketing spend will go into the lead up and the launch of the show itself.
The first high-profile cancellation will come, probably any day now. Low-performing Blood and Oil, Truth Be Told, Minority Report have all had their episode orders cut back.
But it's certainly French for you're going to get canceled soon.
Just not as soon as in years past. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Life in this economy moves fast, as we all know, arguably too fast, and that is certainly proving to be true in the world of high fashion. High-profile designers like Raf Simons of Dior, Albert Elbaz from Lanvin, and Donna Karan from Donna Karan have all stepped away from their labels or from the industry altogether, citing at least in part stress and pressure. Kate Betts is who we talked to about fashion, so we got her on the phone. Kate, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
Why are all these people leaving? What's going on?
Well, you know, what I think is that there is too much information, too much product, too fast, too much demand. And the creative cycle has just gotten way too fast. If you look at fashion, and fashion is the fastest creative cycle, historically speaking, it's faster than technology. But and it's a 6-month cycle, but now it's a 3-month cycle. And actually, if you talk to a designer at a major house like Dior or Chanel, it's a 3-week cycle. They have to create whole collections in 3 weeks.
So what does that mean in real terms? How does it work, you know, in the studio or in the atelier or whatever it is that fashion people say?
Well, I mean, to give you a very quick, I mean, it means they have to come up with the ideas, communicate the ideas to the seamstresses, the people who create the samples, fit the samples, make the clothes, ship the clothes back to the studio, fit them on the models, produce a runway show.
Who is providing this pressure? Is it the designers themselves? Is it the houses they work for? Is it major retailers? Is it the high-end retailers? Who's putting the squeeze on?
Well, I mean, it comes from all different directions. I mean, the retailers want more product. The public wants more product and information. They're consuming information and product at a much faster rate. Because of the internet, obviously. Mm-hmm. But they're also consuming it because of fast fashion, and fast fashion has become kind of the scapegoat for all of this. But I don't think you can point finger at one specific system or person or part of the culture. I think it's just everything is much faster now.
When you say fast fashion, do you mean the actual cycle that we talked about earlier, or do you mean the way that fashion goes from, and you and I have talked about this a lot, from the high end to, you know, Target in a month and a half?
Yes, I'm talking about the way it goes from the high end to Zara, H&M, Target, what have you. It's not a month and a half anymore. It's actually 3 weeks.
That seems insane. Honestly.
Yeah. It is insane, but it's technology has just increased the speed of production and the transfer of information to an incredibly rapid pace.
Okay, so what's the relief valve here? What's going to slow this down and make it make sense again?
Well, I don't know if you can slow it down. I mean, you can't stop progress, but I think, you know, there is a big message. Perhaps a lot of these creative talents, and certainly Raf Simons at Dior, Albert Elbaz at Lanvin. These guys are really the top of their game. They're the top of the industry. So when you see people like that stepping down from huge, important, influential jobs, other people will follow. And then where will the ideas come from?
Well, where then?
Well, I mean, if there are no ideas coming from the high end, the low end of the market doesn't have anything to feed off of. I don't think that you can return to an old way of doing things, but I think that certainly there will be a generation that will question whether this idea of working so hard and under so much pressure is really what they want.
Kate Betts, we talk to her whenever I need to know something about fashion. That's when we talk to her. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, in which we take our martinis shaken, not stirred. Spectre, the new James Bond film, is out today. And just because they could, I guess, the good people at Bloomberg committed a little bit of data journalism to mark the occasion. There have been, according to Bloomberg, over the past 53 years, 24 Bond films totaling 51 hours. Of those 51 hours, 18 of them have been spent with Bond in a suit or a tuxedo. Sean Connery leads all Bonds in times dressed up. He is also, for what it's worth, leads all Bonds in time spent without a shirt on. So go figure that one out. Connery, by the way, also introduces himself as Bond, J. James Bond, fewer times than any of the others did. He is also, and this is just me, no data behind it, he's the best Bond ever. Come on, what, Pierce Brosnan? Forget it. And don't even get me started on Roger Moore. Forget it. All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 46 points today, 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 19 points, more than 0.3%. The S&P 500 off a hair. Let's call it flat. Theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday. And oh yeah, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.